his work in Star Wars, just enough to get him off his co-writer's sofa and into an apartment of his own. But Star Wars, once it became a chase-worthy hit, helped Fox birth Alien. They wanted to follow through on Star Wars, and they wanted to follow through fast, and the only spaceship script they had sitting on their desk was Alien, said O'Bannon. He was granted the exact same budget as Star Wars, $11 million. The British director, Ridley Scott, had decided to switch from historical epics to science fiction after seeing Star Wars at the Chinese theater. He hired Charlie Lippincott, now something of a good luck charm in Hollywood. Alien was released on May 25, 1979, 2 years to the day after Star Wars. It made $104 million at the box office. Alien is to Star Wars what the Rolling Stones were to the Beatles, its producer David Giller said. It's a nasty Star Wars. Helping to shepherd Alien to the screen was one of the last tasks Laddie had at Fox. His spat with the board over whether he should have made the Star Wars 2 deal on Lucas's terms blew up in fall 1979, when the former producer declared his intention to go round up a posse and form a production company. Fox shortened his contract, the nicest possible way of showing Laddie the door. In October, the Ladd Company was founded. Laddie rounded up Ridley Scott, who was hired to direct a script penned by a rather high-strung actor called Hampton Fancher, based on a novella by a strung-out science fiction writer. Fancher and Scott clashed, and Fancher left the movie. Thus was Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick transmogrified into something equally brilliant but rather different, Blade Runner, by a team that had been utterly inspired by Star Wars. No wonder Harrison Ford was the perfect choice to play the replicant-hunting protagonist, Deckard. Not that what they created was anything like Star Wars. Or was it? On the surface, Blade Runner seemed more like a big-budget storytelling positive version of THX 1138. It had the same slow-moving feeling, the lingering scene setting of a future dystopia, a robotic humanity. Lucas had abandoned that whole bummer of a notion and laid claim to our dreams instead. Ridley Scott successfully inhabited our nightmares. Yet the two directors had much in common at this stage, a desire to tell an economical story that preserved as much mystery as possible, a story that was told through the eyes of non-human constructs, whether droids or replicants, who bear witness. "I've seen things you people wouldn't believe," said Deckard's last replicant victim, Roy Batty, in a famous dying speech penned by actor Rutger Hauer. Yes, he wrote it himself, on the same night it was shot. "Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate." In this, its most memorable moment, Blade Runner briefly sheds its science fiction skin and became a space fantasy about war in the stars. Even low-budget filmmakers who were old hands at science fiction were driven to spending unusually large amounts on their next space flicks. Roger Corman had taken his entire Venice Beach staff to see Star Wars at the Chinese theater on day one. It was the kind of thing he'd always dreamed of making. Left in the lurch when Fox grabbed Alien in 1979, he filmed Battle Beyond the Stars, an homage to Star Wars that also liberally plundered the plot of Seven Samurai. At $2 million, it was Corman's most expensive movie ever, largely because of the salaries of its stars, George Peppard and Robert Vaughn. It was also one of Corman's most successful movies, earning $11 million at the box office. It is perhaps best remembered today as the movie James Cameron got his start on. The former truck driver who quit his job after watching Star Wars had made an experimental science fiction special effects movie called Xenogenesis and taken it to Corman, who was always on the lookout for passionate kids like Cameron. Corman put him in charge of the spaceship model shop on Battle Beyond the Stars. Cameron became a one-man ILM. He worked one 85-hour shift on nothing but coffee. He slept on a gurney in the studio and suggested special effects ideas that Corman hadn't thought of. When Corman fired his art director, he found Cameron on his gurney, shook him awake, and offered him the job. Thus began the meteoric career of the only man to beat Star Wars at the U.S. box office twice, Everywhere you looked, would-be filmmakers with fantastic dreams were coming out of the woodwork. Perhaps the biggest unrealized dream belonged to Barry Geller, a serial entrepreneur obsessed with the fringes of science and comparative religion. In 1978, Geller optioned the movie rights for the Roger Zelazny novel from 1967, Lord of Light, which fit his temperament perfectly. The plot, a group of space colonists have used future technology to make themselves immortal and have assumed the names of Hindu gods. They are challenged by a young iconoclastic Buddha figure, Sam. It is hinted in the novel that time is a wheel and the story's events will repeat themselves over and over. Some producers believed the novel's circular plot and religious digressions made it unfilmable. Not Geller. He turned out a script, raised $500,000, and got comic book legend Jack Kirby to do production sketches. The aim of the film, he wrote, was to bring attention to our extraordinary mental powers, just as Star Wars brought recognition of life in the galaxy. He envisioned a massive theme park based on the movie in Aurora, Colorado, called Science Fiction Land. Kirby drew that, too. It would include a mile-wide Buckminster Fuller Dome and a mile-high spire called Heaven. Geller's dream foundered in December 1979 when he and his business partner, Jerry Schaefer, were arrested by the FBI on suspicion of fraud. Geller was cleared, but his partner was indicted for theft, conspiracy, and 3 counts of security fraud. Prosecutors alleged Science Fiction Land would have given Schaefer his own zip code for various nefarious schemes. The whole project, tainted by association, died. But the script had a now famous afterlife. The same month the project perished, the script found its way into the hands of the CIA. The spooks were looking for a Star Wars-like project to help get a fake film crew into revolutionary Iran to rescue 6 American diplomats from their hiding places in the Canadian embassy. The Lord of Light script and Kirby drawings were repackaged under the name Argo. The diplomats were saved, and Geller knew nothing about it until the operation was declassified in 2000. When the Oscar-winning Ben Affleck movie retelling of 2012 failed to mention Geller or Lord of Light, Geller was livid. One visionary who got a happier ending was animator Steve Lisberger. In 1976, Lisberger became fascinated by Atari's first video game, Pong, and imagined a feature-length movie, part live-action actors, part computer animation. In 1977, Lisberger's studio created a 30-second sample of a backlit neon figure throwing 2 spinning discs. The character was electronic. They nicknamed him Tron. The Boston firm moved to California en masse and pitched the idea to major studios. Eventually, Disney came calling. Its old guard wasn't sure about the idea, but the younger video game playing executives were into it. Tron was guided in to land at Disney by Harrison Ellenshaw, a matte painter on Star Wars and Black Hole. Ellenshaw was the ambassador and the young prince of the Disney lot, Lisberger says. It was his belief that sold it. Score another point for Star Wars alumni. Even the most established of franchises were not immune to the Star Wars effect. James Bond, moviegoers were informed at the end of The Spy Who Loved Me in July 1977, was to return in a sequel called For Your Eyes Only. But by the time those credits rolled on screens around the world, the producers were having second thoughts. Why not go for something flashier, a little more Star Wars? Ian Fleming had written a novel called Moonraker back in 1954. Its plot, featuring Bond playing bridge with a wealthy industrialist called Sir Hugo Drax, who later tries to destroy London with an atomic weapon, was promptly tossed out. Instead, Bond was to investigate the theft of a space shuttle and discover his archenemy, Drax, has built a city in orbit. "Other films may promise you the moon," boasted the trailer, "but we deliver." Moonraker, released in 1979, was criticized for taking Bond into new realms of silliness. The film still holds the record for most actors on wires in a single zero-gravity scene. But it also took 007 to new heights at the box office. Its gross was larger than any previous Bond film. Adjusted for inflation, only Thunderball, Goldfinger, and You Only Live Twice beat it. So it seemed Star Wars was bad for imitators, good for true believer filmmakers, and even better for established franchises, so long as they were set in space. Which brings us to Star Trek, the motion picture, 1980. Gene Roddenberry had been trying to spin his TV show's newfound popularity into a movie for the better part of a decade. Paramount had just scrapped the project, and Roddenberry was working on a brand new Star Trek TV series called Phase 2 when Star Wars came out. Phase 2 was itself scrapped, and the pilot episode, written by none other than Alan Dean Foster, was turned into the basis of the movie. It didn't work so well at that length, however. The movie's costs spiraled out of control, reaching $46 million. Lucas saved it, after a fashion, when ILM took over the special effects contract. Still, it made $139 million at the box office worldwide, a respectable amount and enough to guarantee a lower-budget sequel. Leonard Nimoy would later credit Star Wars with kickstarting the Star Trek movie franchise, though the latter would never outperform the young upstart. The franchise Lucas had imitated all along would return to the screen because of Star Wars, but would pale in comparison to it. That much became clear in 1980 when, at long last, Flash Gordon got a full-length movie. Producer Dino De Laurentiis had bought the rights from King Features years before Star Wars came out, but he failed to persuade Federico Fellini to direct it. So Flash lay fallow until his progeny, Star Wars, exploded onto screens. Then, De Laurentiis moved fast. Reviving Flash after a near 40-year absence wasn't so easy. There were fundamental differences of opinion about which direction the movie should take. Scriptwriter Lorenzo Semple figured the caricatures of Flash, Dale, Zarkov, and Ming, not to mention the Birdmen, were impossible to play with a straight face in the 1980s. He wrote a campy version in the style of the 1960s Batman TV series, which he had written much of. But his sense of humor didn't translate for De Laurentiis, who assumed everything would be played straight and ordered up no expenses spared sets and costumes. "I told Dino I didn't like it," said Lippincott, who ended up working as the movie's marketing director. Charlie Lippincott, the Zelig of 1970s and 80s space movies. It was making fun of the whole thing. You had to do it as a fantasy that would work in the eyes of the audience. The budget soared to $35 million. The star, Sam Jones, a former Playgirl pet, fell out with director Mike Hodges, which led to all Jones's lines being dubbed by a still unknown voice actor. The result divided audiences. In the United States, Flash Gordon tanked with $27 million in box office. In the United Kingdom, it was a rousing success, aided by the film's Queen soundtrack and an over-the-top performance by Brian Blessed. But none of this gave De Laurentiis the Star Wars-style franchise he craved. Flash Gordon would live on as a comic, a cartoon, and eventually a sci-fi channel series, which lasted for one season. Flash's one consolation, in the home for retired space fantasy screen heroes, is that he escaped the fate of the $250 million film version of John Carter, the Edgar Rice Burroughs character on which he was based in 2012. Carter barely made its money back, and was even slammed as a Star Wars copy. A century-long experiment was complete. Star Wars had finally, definitively, outlasted its space fantasy forefathers, as surely as Luke Skywalker would become stronger and wiser than his dad. Many movies pillaged Star Wars after its release, but not a single one of them became the target of a copycat lawsuit from Lucasfilm. However, there was one TV show that managed to earn the legal wrath of Lucasfilm and 20th Century Fox, even though the show was first conceived long before Star Wars. In 1968, the same year George Lucas was struggling to organize his thoughts around spaceships, holograms, the wave of the future, TV producer Glenn A. Larson wrote a script called Adam's Ark, in which a ragtag fleet of spacecraft flees the destruction of Earth and searches for humans on other planets. After Star Trek folded, however, no network seemed keen on science fiction shows. Larson turned his attention to a string of hit shows such as The Fugitive, Alias Smith and Jones, and The $6 Million Man. After May 1977, coincidentally or otherwise, Larson returned to the Adams Ark concept. He flipped the script so that the ragtag fleet is fleeing the destruction of its own set of planets and searching for the mysterious, legendary Earth. Adam is renamed Adama and given an admiralty. He is the one holdout against a peace treaty that the humans of 12 worlds are planning to sign with a race of robots, the Cylons. Adama's resistance proves prescient as the Cylons launch a sneak attack in the middle of the treaty celebrations. The Soviet ambassador would later complain about the show, seeing a Cold War metaphor in this tale of treachery and mistrust. Executives at Universal had put out a call for some kind of TV version of Star Wars script if it had a title with Star in it. The 500-page script that Larson turned in, dated August 30, 1977, was duly named Galactica, Saga of a Star World. Larson was given $7 million to make a pilot, the largest budget ever for an episode of a TV show, and not far from the original budget for Star Wars. The armor-covered Cylons looked a little like stormtroopers, albeit in blindingly bright silver. No used universe here. The story of Battlestar Galactica was at least a few light years removed from that of Star Wars. Lucas's rebellion had never been conned into seeking a peace treaty with the Empire. No one in that long-ago galaxy, far, far away, had ever heard tell of a planet called Earth. Galactica's brand of mysticism brought it much closer to the Chariot of the Gods concept of humanity being planted on Earth by superior ancient races, an idea as prevalent in the 1970s as a belief in UFOs. Still, Universal was cautious enough to send Lucas the Larson script. Lucas didn't damn it outright. Instead, he asked Universal not to use the phrase Star World. So, Larson came up with a new class of spaceship, a Battlestar. Lucas felt that the name for Adama's son, Skylar, was too close to Skywalker. Larson changed it to Apollo at the last minute. Lucas also felt that the name Starbuck was too reminiscent of Star Wars. That, for Larson, was a step too far. What really irked Lucas, however, was that Larson contracted John Dykstra to do the special effects for the Battlestar Galactica pilot and Ralph McQuarrie to do the concept art. Dykstra brought much of ILM with him, reforming the country club as a new company, Apogee. He still had much of ILM's equipment, but it wasn't clear whether he had to return it to Lucas. Legally speaking, ILM had ceased to exist. The paychecks stopped coming as of May 25, 1977. The special effects industry was still moribund at that point. Members of the Apogee crew were glad of any work they could get. Fox was upset too. The studio had pitched the concept of a Star Wars TV show to Kenner CEO Bernie Loomis and other potential licensees. Now it seemed Universal was going to beat them to the punch, making it that much harder for any Star Wars show to make it to the TV screen. Furthermore, the Battlestar premiere episode was shown in theaters in Europe as a movie, meaning it had started to compete on Star Wars' home turf. Fox sent Universal a cease and desist in December 1977. When work continued on Galactica, regardless, Fox filed a lawsuit the following June, alleging 34 ways in which Galactica had ripped off Star Wars. Universal countersued, alleging that Star Wars had ripped off the 1939 Buck Rogers serial, to which Universal still owned the rights. Slightly less preposterously, the suit also alleged theft from Silent Running, the 1972 bomb that sunk Barwood and Robbins's film Home Free. But of course, McQuarrie had consciously based the design of R2-D2 on the reverse of Silent Running's robots, making R2 round where his predecessors were square. They waddled, he glided. When the Galactica pilot finally aired on television in September 1978, the same month most theaters finally stopped showing Star Wars, the science fiction community rallied around Lucas. "Star Wars was fun and I enjoyed it, but Battlestar Galactica was Star Wars all over again," opined Isaac Asimov in a newspaper column. "I couldn't enjoy it without amnesia." Writer Harlan Ellison dubbed Galactica's creator Glenn Larceny. Prior to the premiere on ABC, Time magazine called it the most blatant ripoff ever to appear on the small screen. But not everyone agreed that they were watching a ripoff. Dykstra Flex spacecraft shots and laser fire from fighter craft in space do not a copycat make. The more the show developed, the more it staked out its own territory, just as Gene Roddenberry noted that Star Trek had to go 15 episodes to find its footing. The characters are given more psychological dimension than the comic strip cutouts engaged in Star Wars, wrote Newsweek's critic on viewing the pilot. Galactica lasted a single season on ABC. Ratings started out high, but an irregular time slot torpedoed the show. Outraged fans protested outside the network's headquarters. One young fan in Minnesota committed suicide. Larson would reuse many of the sets and equipment for another, more successful TV show, a remake of Buck Rogers. Galactica returned for one more series in 1980 without much of the main cast. Some 23 years on, the Sci-Fi Channel, later Sci-Fi spelled S-Y-F-I Channel, would remake the entire series in a darker fashion, altering one essential detail. The Cylons could now look like humans. It ran for four successful seasons and would come to influence Lucas in the late 2000s when he finally got around to planning a Star Wars live-action TV show. Fox's suit against Universal was thrown out of court in October 1980. Universal's case against Star Wars was likewise dispatched the following May. Fox's case was restored on appeal 2 years later, with the court declaring that it raised genuine issues of material fact as to whether only the Star Wars idea or the expression of that idea was copied. In 1984, Universal paid Fox $225,000 to make the whole thing go away. The claim and counterclaim left one odd piece of legal trivia in its wake. In a decade-long deluge of science fiction movies with borrowed concepts after black samurai helmets and planet-sized weapons, only one U.S. feature film was slapped with a lawsuit accusing it of outright copying. Star Wars. Early in 1978, 20th Century Fox contracted TV producer Dwight Hemian to executive produce an hour-long Star Wars holiday special for CBS. Fox believed 3 years was going to be too long to wait between Star Wars movies. Lucas agreed. The Emmy-nominated Hemian had spent a decade producing specials for the likes of Frank Sinatra and Barbra Streisand. In 1977, he had produced the last TV special to star Elvis Presley, one of Lucas's idols. Hemian had also directed a well-received version of Peter Pan, starring Mia Farrow and Danny Kaye, suggesting he could handle children's fantasy. If his holiday special worked, it could be the pilot for a Star Wars TV series. Lucas suggested a story that focused on Chewbacca's relatives and a galactic holiday called Life Day on his home, Kashyyyk. The Wookiee planet had been recently rejected for The Empire Strikes Back. Now, because Lucas liked to recycle just about every concept ever considered for Star Wars, and because he still had a soft spot for Wookiees, it was revived. Ralph McQuarrie produced paintings of the planet. He provided the names of Chewie's family, his wife, Mala, his father, Itchy, and his son, Lumpy. Lucasfilm produced a Wookiee Bible with everything the writers would need to know about the ape-like species, including how they reproduce. Wookiees have litters. Lucas would also tell one of the writers of the show that Han Solo was married to a Wookiee, but we can't say that. The holiday special is legendarily awful. Not in that so-bad-it's-good kind of way that heralds a cult classic like Star Crash, but in the sense of monumentally boring. Look it up on YouTube and see how many minutes you can suffer through. Before it aired, Lucas and Gary Kurtz took their names off the project. "We were kind of appalled," Kurtz told me. "It was a bad mistake." A quote falsely attributed to Lucas by practically the entire internet has him expressing a desire to destroy every copy of the special in existence with a hammer. But he told Starlog magazine in 1987 it would be released on videotape soon. Here's what he said in 2002. "That's one of those things that happened, and I just have to live with it." Lucas was less restrained in his appearance on Seth Green's Robot Chicken spoof, where, within the safety of satire, he offered his only real public critique of Holiday Special. "I hate it, I hate it, I hate it!" his character screamed from the therapist's couch. Green says Lucas required little coaching. Did it have to be that bad? When Macquarie died in 2012, something turned up in his papers. A treatment for the special, dated March 1978. The author remains unknown, but it reads a lot like Lucas. The treatment begins with Chewbacca arriving at his home and reuniting with his family. Han Solo appears on a video screen, congratulating the Wookiees on the fact that their planet has been chosen to host the galactic festival called Life Day. Solo gives us the stakes. Life Day isn't illegal yet, but the Empire fears it could unify the galaxy and is scheming to shut it down in any way it can. Chewie, the most famous Wookiee, will be the focus of the festival. The starship Musica is on its way to kick off the ceremonies. Meantime, a trader arrives at the Wookiee residence. Chewie buys a video book for his son as a Life Day present, though the trader makes it clear that Life Day isn't a commercial festival. Chewie relaxes with a mind evaporator that plays rock and roll, which Wookiees apparently enjoy. As weird as that sounds, it wouldn't be out of character for George Lucas, rock and roll fan and the man who gave us an equally incongruous Benny Goodman-style swing band in the Mos Eisley Cantina. Chewie then discovers, to his horror, that Lumpy has gone missing. He's stowed away aboard the trader's ship, destination Tatooine. The trader is eventually reached at that familiar cantina, and he agrees to return Lumpy to Kashyyyk via the Musica. Meanwhile, an Imperial commander dispatches a guest star. The treatment suggests Raquel Welch to make sure the Musica never makes it to Kashyyyk. She seduces its commander, dances, literally, into its control room while explaining to Lumpy how starships work, and screws everything up. The droids follow her and notify Leia and Luke, who alert Chewbacca, who takes a shuttle to the starship and flies it to safety. Life Day and Lumpy have been saved, and Chewbacca would finally get the medal he was denied during the final ceremony of Star Wars. Would that have made for the greatest holiday special ever? Probably not. But it might have provided the foundation for a campy cult classic. The treatment appears to have been transformed, however, by Hemian's producers, Ken and Mitzi Welch. Chewbacca was removed from most of the show. Instead, we see his family wondering if he's ever going to show up at all, and watching various entertainments to distract themselves. Life Day remains utterly unexplained throughout the final version. At the end, it appears to be a festival composed entirely of Wookiees in red robes. The show's writers realized, with a dawning sense of horror, that they had been handed a script dominated by characters that didn't speak a word of English. "The only sound they make is like fat people having an orgasm," writer Bruce Vilanch noted. Heavyset himself, he told Lucas he would create the show's dialogue by leaving a tape recorder in his bedroom. Lucas was not amused, nor was he particularly interested in keeping tabs on the show. He appointed David Achenbach, a frat brother of Charlie Lippincott's, as director, but Achenbach was not accustomed to TV directing. The crew found him high-strung. He quit the production after shooting a few scenes. "These people don't know what they're doing," he told Lippincott. The writers did the best with the treatment they were given by the Welches, creating what they hoped were charming scenes of family life on Kashyyyk. Itchy, the young rascal, steals cookies, annoys his grandfather with a toy spaceship, and amuses himself with a hologram of circus tumblers. Mala watches a cooking show. She checks in on Chewie's progress via video screen with Luke and Leia, and distracts Imperial troops who search her home for the unauthorized video screen. The first 10 minutes after the opening credits is nothing but Wookiees roaring at each other. If the writers had left it at that, the holiday special might at least have gone down in history as a kind of avant-garde insurgency, a mime's delight that baffled the mainstream. But this was a variety show. Songs were written. Jefferson's Starship was to perform its single, "Light the Sky on Fire." A cartoon featuring the debut of bounty hunter Boba Fett was in production. Bea Arthur of Maud fame was to sing a song in the Mos Eisley Cantina to the tune of the Cantina Band's swing music called Good Night But Not Goodbye. It all had to be shoehorned into the show somehow. Mark Hamill, at least, resisted plans for Luke to sing a number. In the most horrific example of how the holiday special went completely off the rails, Chewie's father, Itchy, relaxes with the mind evaporator provided by the traitor. But what he witnesses isn't rock and roll. It's singer Diane Carroll, cast by the Welches with two explicit intentions. One, make sure the cast was multiracial, and two, perform an erotic song that was PG enough for the censors. I'm your fantasy, she coos to the old Wookiee. I'm your pleasure. The Wookiee growls with orgasmic delight. Ooh, giggles Carroll. We are excited, aren't we? But even Carroll's song is easier to stomach than the special's ending. Carrie Fisher was going through what Valanche described as her Joni Mitchell period. Showcasing her singing talents, such as they were, was the quid pro quo for her participation. The Welches duly wrote a ballad for Princess Leia, celebrating Life Day to the tune of the Star Wars theme itself. Fisher, who loved to sing but hated the song, appears glassy-eyed and struggles to hit the high notes. By the time Lucas and Gary Kurtz saw what was going on, it was too late to do anything but remove their names. In the long run, it wasn't necessary, Kurtz remembers. Fox was worried that 3 years was too long to wait for the second film, and something needed to be out there in the meantime. It really didn't. But the studios and networks had spoken. CBS was overjoyed to have what would surely be the holiday season's biggest ticket. So many advertisers had climbed on board, the one-hour show was stretched into two. Del Rey published a Wookiee storybook. Kenner, the lead advertiser, prepared to release a line of Wookiee action figures. Never again would they be caught flat-footed by demand. The show was teased for months beforehand. Kids were thrilled that Star Wars, which had only just left theaters, was now showing up on TV. Folks who didn't go to the movies and had only Battlestar Galactica to go on would finally get to see what all the fuss was about. That applied not just in the United States, but around the world. The holiday special was sold and screened in at least 6 other countries, including Canada and Australia. At first, it seemed to have paid off. An estimated 13 million people in the United States alone tuned in for the start. But ratings dropped precipitously after the Boba Fett cartoon at the end of the first hour. By the time Fisher performed her song, most viewers had switched over to ABC or NBC, or switched off altogether. The special, strangely, clung to the edges of Star Wars canon for years. Since it marks the first appearance of Boba Fett and the first time the Wookiee homeworld is mentioned, Lucasfilm couldn't ignore it altogether. That was until 2014, when Lucas took a scorched earth approach to all Star Wars media in which Lucas's name was not in the credits. Only then did the worst Star Wars clone of all vanish from the Star Wars galaxy. It was never released on home video, despite what Lucas said he hoped in 1987, and was only kept alive by fans on bootleg tapes until the YouTube era arrived. At the time, the holiday special seemed the startling self-immolation of a promising franchise. Proof, if any, were needed that the sequel was likely to bomb. For George Lucas, it was an object lesson. Never again would he cede so much control over how his universe was represented. When it came to his sequel, if he was to avoid losing every penny of his Star Wars wealth, he would have to watch the process like a falcon. 15. How to Exceed in Sequels. In July 1978, actor David Prowse toured the United States as Darth Vader for the first time. The former British bodybuilding champion was irked by Lucas's insistence that no publicity photographs were to be taken of him on the set of Star Wars in Vader costume with the helmet off, and further irritated that no information about him had appeared in the movie's press materials. When Vader had placed his footprints in the wet concrete outside Man's Chinese Theater in Hollywood, Prowse had been stewing in London. I created Darth Vader, Prose insisted to a reporter in November 1977. His movements, his mannerisms, are what I and no one else put in the character. So where does Fox get off pretending to the public that the real Darth Vader is inside my black suit when I'm 6,000 miles away? It's disgraceful and dishonest. It was around this time that Prose started signing photographs to Lucasfilm's chagrin. David Prose is Darth Vader. The 1978 trip was an attempt to assert his rightful place, as Prose saw it. His publicist arranged a West Coast tour. He gave a talk at Marin Civic Center, a few miles from Lucas's home, and fielded questions outside a Berkeley comic store surrounded by roughly 1,000 Star Wars fans, many in costume. Asked about his first meeting with Lucas, Prose recalled, "I was confronted with what looked like a young boy." Asked about the sequel, he said it would start filming the following February. Then he offered what a San Francisco Examiner reporter described as a glimpse of a possible plot. Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker are in a do-or-die lightsaber duel when Luke learns that Vader is his father. "Father can't kill son, son can't kill father," Prose said. So the two characters would live to star in the next sequel. His audience cheered wildly. Now, according to Lucasfilm lore and Prose's autobiography, he had no foreknowledge of the plot twist coming in The Empire Strikes Back. It was kept under wraps to the point where Prose was given fake dialogue for the famous scene. "Obi-Wan is your father." Mark Hamill was only clued into what was really going on minutes before the scene was shot. The voice of Vader, James Earl Jones, was the only other actor to receive the correct line. The story goes that Prose learned that Vader was Luke's father during the London premiere in 1980. In fact, he'd already seen a number of press review screenings by that point. So how come Prose was casually discussing it as a possible plot point a year before filming even began? The plot twist itself was only a few months old. Lucas wrote the key second draft of the script, in which Vader announces his parentage for the first time in April 1978. He was obsessively secretive about the revelation and wouldn't even allow his secretary to type up that page. Perhaps Prose had a mole inside Lucasfilm? Nope. He'd said the same thing at a convention around October 1977, according to an interview with the London fanzine called Little Shop of Horrors. "Vader didn't kill Luke's father. Vader is his father." This was decades before the advent of internet-driven fan culture. The word spoilers was not in common currency. Prose's words vanished in the vacuum of forgotten fanzines and a single paragraph at the end of a local newspaper article. Still, they throw a spanner into the works of Star Wars history. After all, this was the twist that transformed everything. The moment Darth Vader officially became Anakin Skywalker, everything in the Star Wars universe changed. The path of the next four Star Wars films became clear. The third movie would be about his redemption. The prequels would cover his fall. The entire arc of Star Wars would become nothing less than the tragedy of Darth Vader. Lucasfilm would like to be able to say that the plot twist was planned way ahead of time, and that its secrecy campaign to prevent anyone finding out about it worked. The official history is questioned by blogger and Toronto-based cameraman Michael Kaminsky, who expended a great deal of energy in The Secret History of Star Wars, 2008, attempting to show that Lucas had no overarching plan for the series and came up with the Vader twist in 1978 on a whim. But what if neither of these explanations was true? What if Lucas happened to mention this possible plot point to Prose on the set of Star Wars in 1976 for a future movie that then didn't seem very likely, and Prose decided to reveal it out of spite at a company he felt was spurning him? Complicating matters still further is a story mentioned in Starlog in 1987, which supposedly came from a source close to Lucas. Apparently, the creator had walked into a small San Francisco science fiction convention shortly after Star Wars was released and casually told a group of fans in an impromptu Q&A that Darth Vader is Luke's father. This was an experiment on Lucas's part to see how far and how fast information would be spread in the SF fan community, Starlog's Bill Warren wrote. The more I studied this strange twist, the more obsessed I became with finding out the truth. Prose's agent did not respond to repeated requests for an interview, so I tracked down Prose at the inaugural Salt Lake Comic-Con and asked Brian Young, who was moderating an onstage interview with Prose, to ask him about the 1978 article. "Never heard of it," Prose said rather quickly. The following day, I waited in Prose's autograph line and presented him with a copy of the article. "I'd be interested to read it," he said. "Can I keep it? I'll be here tomorrow." I came back the next day. Prose had no memory of the article. He is 80 now and uses a wheelchair. I felt bad for harassing a senior, but he is also an important part of Star Wars history, and I knew this might well be the last chance anyone would get to uncover the mystery, so I explained my question again. In a low voice, Prose reeled off a litany of complaints about his treatment at the hands of Lucasfilm over the years. He is banned from the official Star Wars convention, having burned too many bridges, Prose's words, with Lucasfilm. "Sometimes," he confessed, "you get in trouble just for speculating on what's going to happen." "Thanks for stopping by," the controller of the autograph table said to me with cheery menace. Was that it? Was Prose just speculating when he predicted the big reveal? Gary Kurtz says he vaguely remembers something like that. In Making of Return of the Jedi, 2013, Lucasfilm said Prose was persona non grata on the set because he had inadvertently leaked story points early on while making Empire. Emphasis mine. And here's one thing I didn't mention about that Examiner article. Prose actually revealed that the paternal twist would come in a third movie. That throws a different kind of wrench into Star Wars history. Fans and creator alike had been hewing to the notion that this twist was not just unforeseen, but unforeseeable. Yet nasty paternal surprises have been a staple of world literature since Sophocles had the idea for Oedipus Rex. We've seen examples from comic books, Mark Black in Tommy Tomorrow, Orion Darkseid in The New Gods. We've also seen how Lucas began to be influenced by Joseph Campbell's notion of the hero's journey in 1975, too late for the book to matter much to Star Wars, but right on time for its sequel, whereupon Luke, the hero, had reached the stage in his journey of atonement with the Father. Perhaps you didn't need to be George Lucas to know where the next film was headed. Evidently, even the guy inside the sight-obscuring helmet could see it coming. In late 1977, months before Prose's trip to the States, Lucas had begun making lists of planets again, just as he had in early 1973. There was Chewbacca's home planet, Kashyyyk, or is it Kazook, or Gnararlak? There was a gas planet called Hoth, as well as an ice planet as yet unnamed, a garden planet called Bespin, a swamp planet called Dagobah. Lucas began to see disconnected images. A metal castle in the snow. Vader's office with torrents of lava. Some sort of snow battle. R2 after a crash landing, his snorkels sticking out of a swamp. Two guys riding on giant two-legged snow lizards, straight out of the Queen Freya storyline in Flash Gordon. One of them gets attacked by a large snow monster. All of these descriptions went straight to Ralph McQuarrie for immediate visualization. Lucas wasn't intending to write the script, just to help come up with its outline. Armies of screenwriters would have killed for the chance to write the first draft, but Lucas wanted someone with old-time pulp science fiction experience. A friend introduced him to the space fantasy novels of Lee Brackett. It wasn't until Lucas called her in and asked if she'd ever written for the movies that he discovered she was also the Lee Brackett who wrote the screenplays for El Dorado and The Long Goodbye, and co-wrote the adaptation of The Big Sleep with William Faulkner. Lucas knew he wanted the second movie to be more character-driven, more mature, more romantic. Gone with the Wind in outer space. Gone with the Wind's box office take, adjusted for inflation, was the final mountain for Star Wars to scale. Brackett seemed to be exactly the writer he was looking for. There was no time to lose. Even in his moment of triumph, Lucas was still in the land of Zoom and would never be slow again. The fame could be illusory. The fortune could evaporate. Time to strike while the iron of creativity was hot. In November 1977, Lucas sat down with Brackett for a 3-day story conference that formed the basis of a script treatment he wrote shortly after. Sadly, only Lucas's side of the conversation was recorded, but the 51-page transcript showed Lucas had learned the lessons of his last two movies. He wanted to give each of the main characters their own plotline, American Graffiti style. And in the wake of those years of struggle with sprawling Star Wars scripts, he wanted to keep this one to 105 pages at most, short and tight. Many of the plot points followed naturally from the first film. For Luke to continue his Jedi training without Obi-Wan, he would need a new teacher. Someone more like Ben Kenobi from the third draft of Star Wars. A crotchety, crazy creature who is constantly making fun of Luke and reveals the simplest truths almost like a child. Lucas decided to make him small and puppet-like, and wondered aloud if Muppet Maestro Jim Henson, whom Lucas had met while Henson was shooting The Muppet Show across the street from Elstree, was available. "It should be like Kermit the Frog," he said of the character, "but an alien." Brackett had to make clear that the Empire was still a force to be reckoned with after the destruction of the Death Star. The Emperor must be mentioned again, and for the sake of future movies, his power would have to grow. The Rebellion could be under attack from the very start, perhaps on the ice planet, which would also allow for some Dr. Zhivago-style romance amid the snow. And Darth Vader? There's a personal agenda between him and Luke, Lucas told Brackett. He might use Leia and Han to find Luke. There will be a titanic battle between Luke and Vader, ending with Luke escaping down a vacuum tube. Lucas already knew how the third movie will end. When we kill Vader off in the next one, we'll reveal what he really is. He wants to be human. He's still fighting in his own way with the dark side of the Force. As for Han Solo, Lucas knew he wanted to develop him further, but was still struggling with how. Harrison Ford hadn't signed up for a third film yet, so he had to be removed from the action with a degree of uncertainty about his return. Perhaps he could be sent off on a dangerous mission to secure the support of his stepfather, a ruthless merchant, or the head of a galactic transportation union. Perhaps we learn more about how he hooked up with Chewie, which is how we get to see the Wookiee planet. Lucas also wanted to introduce one of Han's old friends, a suave gambler type, who may be a member of a clone family that was apparently responsible for the Clone Wars. The movie would end, he said, with Luke and Leia looking up at the stars, wondering if they'll ever see Han again. Leia, by contrast, was barely developed in the original treatment, except inasmuch as she is caught in a romantic triangle between Han and Luke. She rejects Han, though she is excited by him. Eventually, he gets to land an Errol Flynn kiss that knocks her off her feet. Meanwhile, and very clearly separately, Lucas offers the notion that Luke has a twin sister on the other side of the universe. Placed there for safety, she too is being trained as a Jedi. Notice a pattern here? Like any wise businessman, Lucas is buying insurance for his main money-making assets. These developments all allow the business to continue for as long as possible. The introduction of the Emperor allowed Vader to be killed off. The introduction of the gambler meant we can afford to lose Han. The puppet creature was a hedge against Alec Guinness, who was at that point refusing to participate as the ghost of Obi-Wan. Mention of a sister, another Jedi child planted somewhere safe, would allow us to lose Luke in future episodes. Of course, Lucas had almost lost Mark Hamill thanks to his car accident in January 1977 during Star Wars post-production. To explain away Hamill's facial scar, Lucas knew he would need to have Luke attacked by a monster at the very beginning of the script. The creator was moving as fast as he could to build a decades-long franchise, and to extend the Star Wars universe past the point where it was dependent on any single actor. Inspired by the conference with Brackett, Lucas whipped up a quick story treatment. The vague imaginings from his notes got names. The puppet creature, Minch Yoda. The ice planet, Hoth. The snow lizard, a Tauntaun. And for the first time, the sequel itself got a name, which was announced to little fanfare. The Empire Strikes Back. It sounded hokey to some, reminiscent of old-time adventure serials, but it would achieve Lucas's main goal, announcing on every theater marquee that the destruction of the Death Star was just the beginning. In the outside world, the Star Wars craze continued unabated, and manifested itself in ways that Lucasfilm would never authorize today. The November issue of Vogue included a feature headlined, "The Force of Furs." Inside, 3PO cuddled up to a couple of models in pelts, while Vader looked sternly at a couple more, and stormtroopers tried to strong-arm fur-wearing women. Cantina aliens and skating stormtroopers appeared on Donnie and Marie, the Osmond siblings show. Bill Murray sang the Star Wars song on SNL. It was too late to put together any kind of Star Wars holiday special for 1977, but Mark Hamill showed up in Skywalker garb on the Bob Hope All-Star Christmas special and arrested Hope, dressed as Bar Vader, for malicious mutilation of a marvelous movie. By late 1978, that was no laughing matter. The company had got its legal and licensing act together to the point where it sued the singer Neil Young for dressing small actors as Jawas during his stage show. There was a sense of urgency at Lucasfilm. The company needed to get organized. Lucas brought his old USC friend Howard Kazanjian on board as vice president of development, ostensibly to produce the American Graffiti sequel required by Lucas's contract with Universal. In fact, Lucas was already thinking of severing ties with his Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back producer, Gary Kurtz. "Why isn't exactly clear," Kurtz says. He wasn't aware of any problems until Empire started to go way over budget, but it seems Lucas may have been unhappy with the simple fact that Star Wars had gone over budget too. Says Kazanjian, "During pre-production on Empire, long before a script, George said I should attend as many meetings on Empire as possible, as I would be producing the third film." Notably, Kazanjian was always able to keep his Lucasfilm movies on budget. The company hired its first CEO, Charlie Weber. A veteran of real estate, Weber was picked largely because he'd never heard of George Lucas. He led the acquisition of what became known as the Egg Company, a former egg wholesaler's million-dollar piece of property across the street from the Universal lot where Lucas kept his L.A. office. This would be the center of all Hollywood-based operations, everything that couldn't be done from Marin. "In their best moments," said Kazanjian, "we were trying to build Camelot. Even if worst came to worst in the movie business, Lucas knew the Egg Company building's value would go up regardless." Lucas had personally earned $12 million from Star Wars alone by the end of 1977. Yet Randall Kleiser, once Lucas's roommate, now the successful director of Grease, remembered visiting George and Marcia around this time to find they were still eating from a stack of TV dinners in a large icebox. Kleiser pointed out that they could now hire a cook and watch the light bulbs go off above their heads. As generous as he was with friends, giving away 25% of his Star Wars profits, Lucas was drawn to a relatively simple living. He bought a Ferrari, but mostly drove his 1967 Camaro. His plan was to keep $50,000 a year for living expenses and plunge the rest into building the company. He took more breaks and gave his growing staff presents at Thanksgiving and Christmas. Otherwise, 1977 ended the way it began, with Lucas and everyone around him hard at work on a Star Wars movie. One of the most challenging tasks, of course, was finding the right director. Lucas and Kurtz came up with 100 possibilities before whittling it down to 20, and finally, one, an old hand at movies, a mentor from USC. Irvin Kirshner, age 54, had judged the National Student Film Competition that THX 1138-4EB won 10 years earlier. Now that prize student was asking him to take the reins of the sequel to the world's biggest film. Kurtz took Kirsch, as he was known, out for a drink to float the idea. The two had worked together before. When Lucas called Kirsch days later, he used a couple of winning tactics. Reverse psychology. "You'd have to be crazy to take this on," and outright praise. "I want somebody who, under tremendous pressure, will not cave in. Somebody who has vast experience in films and likes to deal with people and characters." "I felt very flattered," Kirsch said. "He knew how to get to me, the rat." Kirsch's solicitousness in the face of Lucas's flattery may have obscured one important point about the mentor figure. I think George had it in mind that he could direct the film remotely by telling Kirsch what to do, says Kurtz. And Kirsch was not that kind of director. Kirsch did get the idea of Star Wars, though. He had watched the original movie with his 10-year-old son and saw through his young eyes the movie's appeal and core strengths. He was a Buddhist and understood the Force implicitly. He described Star Wars as a morality play, but one that had to move speedily to keep a modern audience's interest. The Lucas-Kirshner relationship moved fast, too, and a deal memo was signed by Valentine's Day. January ended with another story conference, this one with Steven Spielberg and an advertising executive turned writer Spielberg had plucked out of obscurity, Lawrence Kasdan. The trio gathered for the first time to discuss the Indiana Jones movie. Lucas was on fire, spitting out at a rapid clip. There are pages and pages of the transcript in which no one says a word but Lucas. What we're doing here, really, is designing a ride at Disneyland, Spielberg said. He occasionally offered ideas. Lucas gently shut him down. The relationship reflected their standing. Close Encounters opened strong, very strong, but nowhere near the box office records set by Star Wars. The championship of the movie world remained in Lucas's hands for now. Brackett, who had been typing away since her own story conference with Lucas, turned in her draft in late February. It contained some intriguing might-have-beens. Minch Yoda, known here simply as Minch, is able to call Obi-Wan's ghost by the power of the Force, and then proceeds to duel with him, winning a highly formal bout. Luke's father, known simply as Skywalker, also appears in ghostly form, and leads his son through the oath of the Jedi Knights. There is a lot of saluting with lightsabers. Luke salutes the Millennium Falcon when Han leaves to find his stepfather at the end of the script. But Brackett's draft seemed oddly static, especially after all those rollercoaster cliffhangers in the Raiders conference. Luke moons after Leia in the ice base and gets hypnotized by a crystal that pops out of his lightsaber. Han and Leia spend half the movie flirting and canoodling in the broken-down Falcon, just drifting in empty space. 3PO and Chewie repeatedly bicker about the brewing romance. When Vader captures our heroes in Cloud City, he sits them down to an awkward dinner and then lets them roam about the place while under arrest. Cloud City owner Lando Caldar, not yet Lando Calrissian, talks wistfully of missing his clone family. Brackett made odd choices of tone and mistakes in continuity. She winked at the audience a lot, seeming not to get that Star Wars drew its humor from being deadpan earnest. Han tries a line on Leia, "We're just two people alone in the immensity of space," then collapses in a fit of giggles. "I'm sorry, that's too much even for me." Han also says the ice base is safe in obscurity because "I doubt even God remembers where he hung this star," casually introducing a deity to the force-filled galaxy. Vader, whose name Brackett occasionally misspells, pursues Luke out of revenge for blasting his ship at the end of the battle for the Death Star, despite the fact that it was Han who did that. To be fair, this was an error Brackett may have picked up from the Alan Dean Foster novel, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, on which more later. Lucas must have experienced a familiar sinking feeling when he read Brackett's draft. It happened on THX. It happened on American Graffiti, and it was happening again. He outsourced the troublesome task of script writing to a professional, and what came back failed to match the content of the movie in his head. Reading the draft in his first meeting with Lucas after he'd signed on as director, Kirshner was equally concerned. A call was duly placed to Brackett, which was when Lucas learned she was in the hospital. Lee Brackett died less than a month later. She'd been in the final stages of cancer throughout the scriptwriting process and hadn't wanted to say anything. The Empire Strikes Back was to be her last hurrah. Lucas determined to keep her name on the movie. "I liked her a lot," he said. "She really tried her best." Her script had, at least, shown him the way he didn't want Star Wars to be. Lucas set about writing a new draft by hand. He produced much of it while on vacation with Marcia and friends in Mexico, a second vacation in less than a year, unprecedented for the Lucases. Also unheard of was the speed at which Lucas wrote the second draft, He started writing in April and was done by June. No longer was he slumped at the door desks, battling the Bogan force.